Thanks, and thanks, John, for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. I've visited Toronto a number of times with our collaborations. And by the way, Megrez was actually a NIST guy. I don't know if you knew that. So I just moved about a year ago from JILA, a joint institute between NIST. I was actually a NIST employee in University of Colorado, back to University of Michigan. I put both bylines up here because, of course, our labs are up and running in Michigan, but as typical, most of the results that I'm going to show you here were actually taken at JILA. So I want to tell you today about what we call optical multidimensional coherent spectroscopy. This is a technique that was actually, the basic technique was actually pioneered in NMR. Okay, so the idea, it was in NMR, it was called multidimensional Fourier transform spectroscopy. Not a particularly useful name because the Fourier transform doesn't really tell you much about what they're doing. But Fourier transform spectroscopy in NMR was first developed in the 60s and then migrated to these multidimensional techniques in the 70s and 80s. It relies, you'll see, on measuring both the electric field of the signals you're looking at, as well as doing it with high phase resolution and phase stability. These are not so hard to do at radio frequencies where NMR works, but it's very hard to do in the optical regime. That's why only now, in the last 15 years, these concepts are beginning to get implemented in the optical regime. So let me give you a brief outline. I want to start with a very sort of broad overview of why we do spectroscopy and multidimensional techniques and tell you how my group implements them. There's multiple ways to implement them. And then I want to start with looking at a very simple system, basically just a hot vapor of potassium atoms. We are motivated by this because it's somewhat of an ideal model system, something that even us as experimentalists can do the relevant calculations and show that we're getting the right result. However, it turns out we discovered some unexpected in an atomic physicist point of view, where we think that the single atom level structure should describe what's going on, some unexpected results. And then shift gears to semiconductors. And I want to tell you about sort of two results in semiconductors. One is that this technique, I think, gives you fundamental insight into the role of many-body interactions in a semiconductor and the fact that these many-body interactions are the dominant source of the optical nonlinearity that we're probing. And then finish up with talking about size-resolved measurements of a quantum dot ensemble. So one of the powers of this technique is it actually allows you to resolve different frequency groups, and when that's due to size fluctuations in an interstructure, different sizes. And what we can show is that we can actually observe clear coherent control through Rabi flopping, even though that gets washed out when you typically look at an ensemble. All right, so again, let's start with a big picture of spectroscopy. So why do we want to do spectroscopy, and what kind of spectroscopy am I talking about? So what I'm thinking about is I have a sample here, and I'm going to illuminate it with an incident field. I'm just drawing this as an arbitrary electromagnetic field at this point. And what will happen then is that field will induce a polarization in the sample. All right. And so on the other side of the sample, we have the field that was incident plus a re-radiated field here, okay, due to the induced polarization. An important thing is if you solve Maxwell's equations in the far field, there's a factor of I, a 90-degree phase shift between the re-radiated field and the induced polarization. All right? So in this case, I've assumed the polarization is in phase with the incident field. That means there's a net 90-degree phase shift. If I now do the phasor addition of these, the amplitude is going to be about the same as the incident field, but there will be a phase shift with respect to it. All right? So this is what would happen if this material were a dielectric, has an index of refraction, which simply causes a phase delay. But of course, we extract information by tuning the frequency. So let's assume this is basically described by a classical simple harmonic oscillator, and we know it's going to have some resonant frequency here. There's some transition in the sample, and as we tune it, the amplitude is going to go up, and the phase is going to shift. So this might be where we're tuned now, below the resonance. As we tune onto the resonance, the amplitude of the polarization will increase. I've shown that here. But there will also be this 90-degree phase lag. And so if we combine that 90-degree phase lag with this factor of I here, that means this re-radiated field is out of phase. These are now going to destructively interfere. They're going to cancel. We're going to see less light. And we attribute that to basically an absorption resonance in this sample. And of course, if we tune higher, that now they have 180-degree phase lag. We're back to a net 90-degree phase shift. And again, it just looks like an index refraction. So you can see what I'm thinking about here is what you would call absorption spectroscopy, where you have incident light, and we're looking at how the sample absorbs. There are, of course, different types of spectroscopy, for example, fluorescence or luminescence, where you're exciting it and looking at the spontaneous emission. For now, that's not what I want to think about, because this is what connects better to the nonlinear spectroscopy I'm going to tell you about. And of course, the information comes from looking at this line shape here and seeing that there's some transition here at a certain frequency, okay, and it has some width. However, in this regime, it turns out there's some very important ambiguities about what this is telling us, right? So the first ambiguity has to do with inhomogeneous broadening. So if we see a broad line like this, we do not know intrinsically whether this is because we have a resonance with an ensemble of oscillators that all have the same center frequency and the width we see here, or alternatively, we could actually have an ensemble where they all have slightly different center frequencies and a much narrower width, and so this line shape is actually not characteristic of the width of the resonance, but it's actually the width of the distribution here. So where might this happen? The classic example in atomic physics is, of course, Doppler broadening, where I have a gas of atoms that are moving. Some are moving towards me, they're blue-shifted. Some are moving away from me, they're red-shifted. Okay, and so this is where this was originally sort of discussed a lot. In the cases that I'm interested in, this is typically going to happen, for example, because I want to look at some kind of nanostructure. There's a quantization energy which depends on size, and I have some dispersion in sizes, which is going to give me this kind of distribution as well. The other ambiguity is if I see two peaks like this. So I don't know a priori whether these two peaks are because I have a pure substance that has two transitions in it. Okay, so for example, I'm looking at a transition from a ground state to two different excited states, or if I have a heterogeneous sample. Okay, and so sort of in a quantum mechanical point of view, I would put it, so these are what I said, I'd say this is sort of, I'm describing it as a three-level system, or I have two different two-level systems. So how do I overcome this problem? All right, well, as I said, this is linear spectroscopy, where I assume the polarization was linearly proportional to the incident electric field. And with the advent of the laser, we could overcome that, drive up the intensity here. So now we need to worry about higher order responses. You can show through group theory that this guy requires broken inversion symmetry. So I'm actually going to ignore that term, because I want a method that is universal, will apply to any material, so I'm going to focus on this term right here. What we'll actually do is we'll illuminate the sample with three incident fields, and in my case, as I'm doing time domain spectroscopy, so these are going to be pulses, but I'm going to allow them to be tagged by both a center frequency, a wave vector, and this prefactor here will include the fact that it might be a function of time, so this would be a pulse. So this little I might, for example, indicate the time zero of this pulse. And I'm going into a complex notation here, so I have a C dot C. So let's plug that in. This is starting to look kind of ugly here. I plug it into this term right here. I have all these terms. If I multiply that out, that's an awful lot of terms to worry about. But I can simplify things quite a bit. So first of all, if I have three pulses, I might as well use them all. All right. So I'm not going to worry about terms that don't include all three pulses. So for example, I worry about a term which is EA, EB, EC. The term that's EA, 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 I say, well, okay, let's not worry about that, all right? And I'm also going to include, look at terms that only have approximately the same frequency as the incident field. So what I want to work is in the same spectral regime. And you can think about how that would happen, since this we have this omega in here. In the starred part of this, this omega has a minus sign. So for example, one term might be where I pick up EA star, and then EB, and then EC. And so the omega in the EA and the EB cancel, and I just have the frequency of the final field, which is roughly the same one. So when I do that, these are the terms I'm left with. There's only three of them, determined by which term has the star on it. And indeed, in the laboratory, because of the fact that we have these wave vectors mapping these fields, these guys actually go in different directions. And so based on selecting the direction of the field that comes out, I can actually choose only one of these terms. And so that makes it much simpler. I'm going to show you that even so, each of these terms has multiple terms within it when you make the calculation. And so one of the advantages of this technique is we can actually even do better about isolating them. So how does this actually work? Let me try to explain for you physically how this interaction of these three pulses gives rise to a signal. So here I'm going to sketch sort of in real space the sample with the different fields. Here I'm going to sketch what's happening in a two-level system, and so this discussion is just for a two-level system, and over here I'm going to sketch what happens in time. So we come in with a first pulse with wave vector Ka. It excites the sample, and the effect we want to worry about is that it puts the sample into a coherent superposition state between the ground state and the excited state. So I've shown that here. This is a coherent superposition state. And of course, a coherent superposition state is going to oscillate at the same frequency as the resonance, so it has a phase associated with it. So I've sketched the phase fronts here as these dashed lines, and I'm showing that over here. Here's the pulse, and here is that coherent superposition radiating, and of course, it's going to decay. It will decay at what we call the dephasing time, which has to do with how the sample interacts with the environment. The second pulse now comes in. So what happens is wherever that second pulse is in phase with the polarization left behind by the first pulse, it promotes the system into the excited state. Wherever it's antiphase, it actually drives it back down into the ground state. Okay? So I show that here. So this is now a population in the excited state. This is the depletion, or actually in the other cases, it's the putting it back in the ground state. Since this is now in a population term, it no longer is oscillating. It doesn't have a strong time dependence. And the important thing is that if we look at the sample, wherever we put it in the excited state, we're actually going to block some of these transitions, so we'll reduce the strength of the absorption at that point. Wherever we put it back in the ground state, we have the full absorption of the original sample on the resonance. So if we think about this, what that means is in the transverse direction, we actually have a modulated absorption. Okay, that modulated absorption actually looks like what we'd call a transmission diffraction grating. So now we bring in the third pulse, and we can think of it diffracting off this modulated absorption. It's going to go in a direction, minus Ka plus Kb plus Kc. And this picture I can think of is what happens is it puts the sample back in a coherent superposition state, but that coherent superposition state is modulated by what happened before. And again, I show that oscillating coherent superposition state. So if you know much about either NMR or optics, you'll recognize that this is actually what's called a photon echo experiment, first done in 1964 by Sven Hartman at Columbia. Inspired by, again, by the spin echo in NMR. And in those measurements, what you do is you simply put a detector here and you measure the intensity of this signal as you change the delay between these pulses. And it turns out because of what we know as a photon echo, which I'm actually not going to explain because we don't need it for 2D spectroscopy, but you can show that the decay of this signal is a function of simply the delays between, actually it's pulse A and pulse B, map out the homogeneous line width, so the phasing of the individual oscillators, despite the fact that you have the presence of inhomogeneous broadening. So that's why this was a powerful technique. So people, as I said, have been doing this since the 60s. What's the difference between this and what we're now calling this multidimensional coherent spectroscopy? Okay. So again, here is my pulse sequence. And let me pop up here, so sort of just a phasor for the emitted signal and a phasor for the incident field. So what we're going to do is we're going to coherently measure the signal field, the electric field of this, as a function of time that it's emitted, and also as a function of the delay between the first two pulses. And the important thing is that the phase of this emitted signal is actually determined by what happened during this time here. Okay? And we're going to correlate these by taking a two-dimensional Fourier transform with respect to this time t and this tau over here. Now, for a simple two-level system, that's pretty boring, but it's a good place to start. So we have some resonant frequency, and when we take that two-dimensional Fourier transform, we're just going to get a single peak that's at the resonance frequency in both axes. And I want to explain for you how I plot things. So this vertical axis is going to be the Fourier transform with respect to this initial delay. We call tau, so we call that omega tau. You'll also see me calling that the absorption frequency because we think of that as the frequency at which the sample absorbed when the first pulse hit it. Horizontal axis this way is the Fourier transform with respect to the time over which the signal is emitted, t. We'll call that omega little t, or we're going to call that the emission frequency. Okay. Now, there's one slightly complicated feature I want to make sure you understand. This pulse is the conjugated pulse in this sequence. That means we have a minus sign on this omega tau. So this omega tau actually has the opposite sign from omega t. Now, some people just ignore this minus sign and just flip their plots up. I'm going to try to be careful and actually keep the minus sign. So the magnitude of this is increasing going down and negative. This is positive and increasing going up. So I'll typically try to plot this dashed line here to remind you that this is the frequency, this anti-diagonal is actually the place where the magnitudes of these two are equal. The reason I'm being pedantic and keeping this minus sign is it turns out it's useful to change the time ordering of these pulses in some case. And so these signs flip, and actually once you get used to it, you can quickly look at these and understand what the experiment is by the way all these are organized. So the important thing now is that if we have an inhomogeneously broadened system, what we see is a line shape like this. It becomes elongated along the diagonal, and you can understand this pretty easily because each one of the two-level systems has a different point on the diagonal. They're still correlated, okay? And we can directly measure from this the diagonal direction is actually dominated by the inhomogeneous broadening, and the cross-diagonal direction is dominated by the homogeneous broadening. So if we have a spectrum like this, first of all, we know it's inhomogeneously broadened. And directly from this spectrum, we can measure both the inhomogeneous and the homogeneous line width. It turns out it's not completely orthogonal, that they're actually slightly mixed. But if you have the whole line shape, you can actually fit it and get both of them. The other thing that's important is that you can actually measure the homogeneous line width as a function of cross-diagonal position, of basically position within the homogeneous distribution. Now, in a Doppler-broadened gas, this doesn't vary, so the atomic physicists wouldn't have thought about this, but in a lot of other systems, it does vary. And if you did an old-fashioned photon echo experiment, what you would see is a non-exponential decay, but you'd have no clue why it was non-exponential. You have no clue which part was decaying slower, whereas here we can directly see those effects and see whether or not what part is where the how the decay is depending on the energy in the inhomogeneous distribution. So what does this require? This requires that we measure the field, not the intensity. As I told you in the old photon echo experiments, for mixing experiments, people just measured the intensity. All right. So of course, in optics, our detectors don't measure field. Okay, they measure intensity. And so what we need to do is we need to interfere it with a local oscillator pulse and do heterodyne detection. It also requires extraordinarily precise stepping of the delays, especially of this tau here. And the reason for that is twofold. So first of all, if my tau was jittering just on a short time scale, that would blur out this cross-diagonal width, so that's bad. But moreover, I'm going to show you that we don't just measure the magnitude of this field, we actually measure its phase. We do it in terms of the real and imaginary parts. And the problem is, let's say we had a very small error in how we step tau. Well, over a couple steps, that wouldn't really matter. But if we take, say, 1,000 steps, let's say that error is 1/1,000th of a wavelength, over 1,000 steps, that's a whole wavelength. And if you think about it, if you have an error like that, it actually looks like a phase shift, and it would completely flip the real and imaginary part. So we need to make sure that it's precise over the long enough, over the whole range, so we really can have a clear definition of what the phases are. So how do we do that? So first of all, we don't use the flat geometry that I showed you. We actually use what's called the box geometry. So we have four pulses, actually, that are flying along in space next to each other, oriented on four corners of a square. We take a single lens, we focus them, and that causes them to both focus and cross at a point in space where we put the sample. During our measurements, this fourth pulse we call the tracer is actually blocked. So this signal, this minus Ka plus Kb plus Kc, comes out on the fourth corner of the square. We then take a beam splitter, we take part of this tracer pulse, and we bring it over here as a reference. And then we looked at the spectrum. So it turns out that there's a very well-known algorithm where if you have two pulses and you look at the spectrum of their interference, we call it a spectral interferogram, you can do a series of steps that if you know what this pulse is, you can figure out what this unknown signal is. And so we can figure that out, the complex spectrum, including all of the phase information, so that basically you can either have it as the electric field in the time domain or effectively the electric field in the spectral domain. This tracer pulse serves another purpose, which is in order to define the real part, we need to know the phase of the reference, and so we actually can then, when we're done taking a set of measurements, we can actually unblock it and measure the phase of the reference with respect to the tracer. So what we need are four pulses flying along in space, not overlapped, okay, that are all phase related to each other. And this is actually somewhat of a challenge. So how do we define the phase relationship between pulses that aren't overlapped? So what we do is we build a Michelson interferometer. Okay, so that's looks like a Michelson there, but that's too easy. We make it a Michelson of Michelsons. Okay, so each arm is itself a Michelson. All right. So it turns out that if you lock up each of these sub-Michelsons so that they have a fixed delay with each other, with respect to each other, so they have a bright or a dark fringe, that then you can actually lock them all up. All right. So what we do is we actually put in a CW laser, as well as the pulses. This, what you see here, is the end mirror of these arms is actually a single mirror. Okay, so all the light hits it. It is dichroic, so the pulses go flying through it, but the CW beam gets reflected back into the Michelson. So the CW one is the one that's actually acting as this is a real Michelson. And the usual outputs of a Michelson, which is the other side of this beam splitter, is merely a diagnostic. So we take this CW interference pattern here, and we now use that to enable a servo loop, which locks the delays so that we have a mirror in here mounted on a piezoelectric. We use it to lock the delays so that we know exactly the phases between all these pulses. And so the CW laser is allowing us to lock the delays in all the arms of the Michelson, and that means that the phases of these femtosecond pulses are well-defined. Now, the problem with this would be fine if we wanted one set of delays. We could just do that. But we want a whole range of delays, so we need translation stages in here to do that. And now, of course, if we drive one of these translation stages, the feedback circuit's going to try to fight it. It's going to try to fix the fact that the path length is changing. So what we have to do is we actually disable the feedback loop under computer control. We drive the stage, okay, we stop it, we re-enable the servo loop, we take our spectrum, and then we repeat that. It's a little bit tricky to do, but it's not so hard. And actually, in one of our setups now, literally the computer sits there and watches the fringes go by on each one of these arms, literally counts. It's, okay, four fringes have gone by, time to stop the stage and lock it, right? And we can show that we can go out by about 1,000 steps and come back, and really the phase is back where it should be, so it's phase stable. Now, this might sound a little bit challenging to implement in the lab, okay? Again, we need the fact that we need all these pulses to come together, and once they come out of this apparatus, we can't have any single pulse bounce off a mirror that the other ones don't, because that will mess up the relative phase. So how do we do that? So we build one of these interferometers very carefully. So this is an aluminum plate. It's been milled out, so all the mounts are sitting on the plate. There's no sort of post. There's another one of these plates. It's also Michelson. We align it. They're sitting there, and then we simply pick one up, and we flip it over, and we put it above the other one upside down. So we basically have an optic sandwich here, okay? But it's very stable. All the four pulses come out in exactly this geometry we want, okay? So this might be a little bit different than perhaps a lot of us are used to, where we build things on the table and then, you know, you sort of build the parts that you want. This actually took a good bit of engineering to make it work well, but it's very stable. The nice thing about it is that, so this is a picture of it on the table. These are the electronics that drive it. Is that, you know, often within about an hour in the morning, they're taking data with it, whereas a lot of these 2D setups that people have built, half the day is spent, you know, tweaking it before you start taking data, whereas this spends a lot more time in science mode. It's also taken data for 30 hours straight and stayed locked the whole time. Okay, so let me finally show you a 2D spectrum. So this is an atomic vapor, specifically potassium. There's these classic D1 and D2 lines of potassium that are in the near-infrared. So they're the transition from the 4S1/2 to the P1/2 and P3/2 states. So if we look at the absorption spectrum, this black line is the absorption spectrum, we have this classic ambiguity I told you about. We see two peaks. If we didn't know this was a potassium vapor, we would say, well, we don't know if these are two peaks in one substance or we have a mixture. Just for your reference, this is the laser spectrum showing that it overlaps both of these. So this is what the 2D spectrum looks like. Again, this is what we call the absorption frequency, and this is the emission frequency. And if we look at this, again, here's the diagonal. We see that there's a peak here on the diagonal, which corresponds to absorbing at the D1 line and emitting at the D1 line. And there is also a peak here, which corresponds to absorbing at the D2 line and emitting at the D2 line. So these two peaks are basically just the two-level physics of the individual transitions here. But what we also see are these peaks here. We call these off-diagonal peaks or cross-peaks. And we see that this one, for example, means that it's absorbed at the D1 line and emitted at the D2 line, and this one is the opposite. So why do these lines exist? It turns out there's two reasons for that. So in one of them, what happens is the first pulse puts the system in a superposition state of the ground state and the lower state, the P1/2. Then the second pulse converts that to a population. But what's happened now is that's depleted the population in the ground state. And so when we then create a coherent superposition between the ground state and the P3/2 state, that's actually modulated by this ground state depletion that gives rise to a signal there. So we call that a ground state depletion signal. There's a second term, okay, where what happens is the first pulse puts it into a coherent superposition between the ground state and the P1/2. The second pulse puts it in a coherent superposition between the ground state and the P3/2, but that is equivalent to a coherent superposition between the P1/2 and the P3/2. The third pulse then comes in, and it actually drives it from here to here, but that leaves behind a coherence between these two states. Okay? It turns out in the language of NMR, this coherence is called a zero quantum coherence, so we call this kind of feature, this term here, a zero quantum coherence. This one does not depend on the delay between the second and the third pulses. This one does, because this thing oscillates. So it turns out if you look at this spectrum as a function of the delay between the second and third pulse, these peaks will oscillate actually because of the interference between these two. All right. There's one other feature I want to point out to you here and keep it in your mind for a little bit later. If you notice the strength of these peaks, this peak lies in between these two. Okay. And for very simple arguments, you could say that should be the case. if this has some oscillator strength, this has some fraction of that, this should be the oscillator strength of this guy to this transition to the fourth power, this one is this one to the fourth power, this is this one squared times that one squared. So this one should be the geometric mean of the strength of those two. Okay? And that actually survives if you worry about things like laser detuning and all. So remember that, and I'll tell you when to recall it when we come back a little bit later. So first of all, let me emphasize that the presence of these cross peaks is what distinguishes between having uncoupled two-level systems and a coupled three-level system. These cross peaks are also the whole ball game in NMR, where they're used to determine if two nuclear spins are coupling to one another. And so this is actually how NMR gets molecular structure information, because the strength of these peaks is basically a measure of how far apart the spins are. So as I said, we can actually get the real part of the spectrum. Okay, what I've been plotting here is the magnitude. And part of the reason I started with this discussion of the fact of phase in a simple linear spectrum is that the phase here is significant as well. It's a similar phase. It's the phase of the nonlinear polarization with respect to the net phases of all the incident pulses. Okay. The problem is there's a couple ambiguities. So first of all, there's a question of how well we can actually define zero delay. Can we define it to the point where truly the phases line up? And the answer to that is no. These pulses are about 100 femtoseconds long. And sort of the uncertainty is on the order of a few cycles of light. Okay. But the good thing is that we can actually treat that uncertainty in the delay as a phase delay if we can figure out what it is. And there's also the phase of the reference. I told you that we dealt with that with the tracer. So how do we deal with these? What we actually do is we take all four pulses and we literally image them on a CCD camera. This is what it looks. This is actually real experimental data. This is what it looks like when all beams are in phase. If one beam is pi out of phase, it looks quite different. So we go from basically a grid to a checkerboard. Okay? So you can see that this pattern cares about the phase. That's not so surprising because it's sort of this sort of, if you will, transient grading kind of effect that's giving rise to the signal. It turns out that analyzing this whole two... So by the way, there's a spot of dust there in case you didn't believe that this was a real experimental image there. Analyzing these whole figures is not the best way to do it. What you do is you get actually just an interference pattern between them pairwise, and what you need is the relative phase between these two guys here. So with that, we can actually determine the real part of the spectrum. And so what I show you here is the experimentally measured real part. Okay, so what we see is a positive peak here. This is now going plus and minus, these weak negative wings here. So that looks okay, but what should we expect? Again, we can actually do a fairly simple theory using the optical block equations and calculate what it should look like. This actually includes finite pulse effects, and we see very good agreement between these two. So we're convinced that we're really getting the phase correct, and it's measuring, everything's measuring the way we want. So let's turn to a slightly different situation. So as I said, we can do different types of spectra, but depending on what the time ordering of these pulses are. And so another interesting one, we actually call it two quantum spectrum. Is where we move the conjugated pulse to be the third one. Okay, and so where is that interesting? It's interesting in a three-level system like this, where instead of having two excited states that are close together, these are actually now separated by the optical frequency, and there's actually an optical dipole between these. So what happens is the first pulse comes in just as before. It creates a coherent superposition state between the ground state and the first excited state. The second one is now going to come, and it's going to drive a coherent superposition state from the first to the second, but it turns out that's equivalent then to creating a coherent superposition state between the ground state and the second excited state. There is no dipole moment here. You cannot directly access this. This is not radiating at the second harmonic, but the system is perfectly capable of being in this coherent superposition state. So I sketched that here. So this is the coherent superposition state between the ground state and the first state. And now you see this is at twice the frequency because this spacing is twice as high. The third pulse comes in, and actually you can think of it as driving it back down here, but that leaves behind a coherence here. And so that's what radiates during this third time period. And again, what we're going to do is we're now going to scan this second delay here. That's going to be sensitive to the phase evolution during this time. And that will then read out in the initial phase of this. And so we scan these two, and we now take a Fourier transform with respect to this delay and this delay. So what we would expect is to have a system where we have this level structure, a ground state, a first excited state, and then a second excited state we can access optically. And let's try that on potassium. And if we look at potassium, we see that, well, there are some states up there that are accessible, a 5P and a 4D. But it turns out they're well outside the laser bandwidth. And so naively, you would say, well, we should expect no signal in this experiment. Since I'm telling you about it, you're probably guessing that there is a signal, and indeed, this is what the spectrum looks like. So now, this is now the Fourier transform with respect to this first delay. This is now the Fourier transform with respect to the second delay. You see all of these frequencies are roughly twice of these, and we see these clear peaks. So what's going on? Why do we see a signal? Okay, clearly it's not these states we saw here, these 5P and the 4D, but there's a hint because this is the diagonal, and it says that the frequency during the 2 quantum period is at exactly twice the frequencies of the D1 and the D2 line. Okay, so this suggests that maybe the way this is happening is there's two atoms involved. So indeed, we attribute to multiple atom effects, and let me give you a simple picture here. So let's say we have two two-level systems. We can do a Hilbert space transform, go to the product basis, where we have a ground state, that's both of these guys in the ground state. We have two singly excited states, one is this guy excited, the other one is this guy excited, and we have a doubly excited state where they're both excited. Oh, well, this looks pretty promising now because we see we have this guy, this is the ground state, the singly excited, and the doubly excited. And indeed, if you go through the calculation on this level structure, you see terms that look exactly like these two quantum coherences I was talking about. But hopefully your physical intuition is quite bothered by this, because all I've done is some mathematical transformations, and I've said there's a new signal, right? So that, as a physicist, I don't like that. And so if you were careful and you really calculated all the terms, what you discover is these new terms completely cancel. Okay, so there's zero signal, and it tells you that indeed your intuition is right. This was the way to do the calculation. It was much simpler. But it allows you to take into account the possibility that there's interactions between these two guys. And so those interactions could mean that the energy shifts a little bit. If I put one atom in the excited state, the other atom's energy shifts a little bit. Or maybe there's a change in the dipole moment, or maybe there's a change in the line width. Any one of those breaks these cancellations, and now we see signals that exactly look like these double quantum signals. Okay. Now that was a hand-waving kind of explanation, so we recruited a theorist, Shaul Mukamal, so he writes down some big Hamiltonian like this. This is now the dipole-dipole interaction term. They use molecular dynamics to actually figure out what these coupling terms are as a function of time, how they fluctuate. We get pseudo-excitonic states. They put them into their existing code, and they do a calculation. So this is now the experiment again, and this is the simulation that they've done. And you can see it agrees quite well. There are peaks in the same places. The line shapes are roughly correct. You can see the amplitudes don't quite match. These are closer to equal. This is communication failure between experimentalists and theorists. We actually tuned it to make up for the difference in dipole moments, and they just tuned their spectrum to be halfway in between. Okay, but that confirms that's what's going on here. Okay, so let me shift gears now to, are there any questions on this part? I'm going to go from atoms to semiconductors. Hopefully you guys will stop me if you have questions along the way. No? Okay. So let me shift gears to semiconductors. So I was talking about potassium, an alkali atom, which is nice. It's a single electron atom, so a lot of atomic physics has done that. So the equivalent in semiconductors is probably gallium arsenide, which has a direct gap, so it interacts strongly with light. Okay, this is the band structure of gallium arsenide. It looks pretty complicated, but all we really need to worry about is this bit here close to the direct gap. And so what we would typically do is we treat these as two parabolic bands with different curvatures because you have different effective masses for the electrons in these two bands. And of course, if we excite this with light, what happens is we take an electron from the valence band and we give it the photon energy to go up into the conduction band. And in a 3D semiconductor, a bulk semiconductor, the turns out the dipole moment for that transition is pretty much independent of K. So all we really need to worry about is the density of states. And if we calculate the density of states in three dimensions, what we see is this square root behavior. Zero is the energy to cross the band gap. And then we see this rising absorption. There's more states as we go up. However, this has neglected an important thing, which is the Coulomb interaction. So why does the Coulomb interaction matter? Well, when we removed an electron from here, we left behind a hole, basically an electronic bubble. Okay, it is effectively positively charged. It's the lack of an electron. And of course, the electron up here is negatively charged. These two will attract each other just as an electron and a proton attract each other. They will form a bound state, okay? And that bound state results in a strong absorption feature here, which we call an exciton, okay? And you actually see here, this is a calculation. This is the 1s, the 2s state, and so forth, okay? Now, this binding energy, so this is in theorist units normalized to the binding energy. This binding energy is about 10 millielectron volts to 4 millielectron volts. It's actually 4 millielectron volts in bulk gallium arsenide. So you typically don't see this at room temperature, but if we cool the sample down to helium temperatures, then we see this. Now, you don't see such a nice spectrum. In reality, what you usually see is something like this red curve where you have a bit more broadening, and so you see an exciton well separated and just kind of a lump at the band edge. Now, I'm not going to tell you about bulk gallium arsenide, but rather what we call a quantum well. So what we've done is we've taken a very thin layer of gallium arsenide, about 10 nanometers, and put it between two layers of aluminum gallium arsenide, which has a wider band gap. And so the transverse potential is a square well. So for the students in here, you've probably calculated a square well in your quantum mechanics class, and you said this is a really stupid problem because nature doesn't make square wells. Well, nature doesn't, but mankind does. So this is actually, if you solve this, the states in these really match what you calculated in your quantum mechanics class, assuming you had finite barriers. So what happens is if this is the bulk band structure, it turns out I need to tell you one more thing, which is that there's actually two valence bands called the heavy hole and the light hole, that when we confine it, what happens is we split this degeneracy at k equals 0. We actually shift the conduction band up a little bit. So we can make two optical transitions from each of these valence bands to the conduction band. These are both, there's excitonic states associated with both of them. And so if we look at the absorption spectrum at low temperature, we see this strong peak, which is this heavy hole exciton, and another peak, which is this light hole exciton. Okay? And so we clearly see those. So now what does the 2D spectrum look like? So here is the 2D spectrum. Again, this is the absorption spectrum. It's a slightly different sample. Here's the heavy hole exciton. Here's the light hole. In this case, there's a little bit of strain, and this is actually the continuum, the unbound electron hole pairs from the heavy hole. Here is the laser spectrum. If we look at this 2D spectrum, so this is the photon echo or the rephasing sequence I've been telling you about. You notice I've now switched from atomic physics to condensed matter, so these are now photon energies in millielectron volts and not frequencies in terahertz. But again, this is the emission energy and this is the absorption energy. We clearly see there's a peak here on the diagonal associated with the heavy hole, and there's a peak here on the diagonal associated with the light hole, and there's these off-diagonal peaks. And I want to tell you that these are co-circular polarized excitation pulses as well. So when you look at the spectrum, there's immediately some surprises. Okay? So the first surprise is the fact that there is even an off-diagonal peak. So why is that a surprise? Well, I need to show you the magnetic substates that are relevant. So the heavy hole is minus 3 halves and plus 3 halves. The conduction band is minus 1/2 and plus 1/2. And the light hole is minus 1/2 and plus 1/2. Since we have circular polarized excitation pulses, that means we need to make a spin one transition. So we go from here to here and here to here. So what does this look like? It looks like two uncoupled two-level systems. And so naively, I expect no off-diagonal peak, but I see one. The other surprise I primed you about, does anybody see what it is? I told you to remember something from the 2D spectrum I showed you of potassium. This guy is the strongest peak. I heard a couple people say that, right? So this is the strongest peak. It shouldn't be. It should be in between the two diagonal peaks. The other one is the line shape. So I haven't shown you much. I showed you a real, this is now the real part, not the intensity. And so in the potassium case, it was a positive center peak with these weak negative wings. That is not what you see here. You see a positive peak with a negative peak on the other side, okay? In the Lengo, this is called a dispersive line shape. It kind of looks like the index refraction, not an absorption feature. Indeed, when I showed this spectrum to some of my physical chemistry friends, they told me I didn't know how to do the experiment, and I had mixed up the real and imaginary parts, because this is what the imaginary part should look like. Okay, so I had to convince them that they were being unfair and that this is really physics. That's part of the reason the potassium experiments were nice, because it showed we could get it right. Okay, the other thing is these vertical stripes here. So this is actually due to this electron hole continuum, right? Now, there's some people who say that this electron hole continuum should look like an inhomogeneously broadened set of two-level systems. That should give us a diagonal feature. Okay, it gives us a photon echo, which should be over here. Instead, we see this vertical feature. And I can kind of explain all of these phenomenologically, but instead what I want to do is show you a theory that was done primarily by Peter Thomas and Torsten Meyer and Marburg. The same theory has been implemented by Shaul Mukamal's group. And so the approach is to start with a one-dimensional chain. Okay, each site on the chain has this level structure. They then adjust the coupling between the sites to get the correct effective masses at the band edges. They then turn on the Coulomb interaction and adjust it to match the exciton binding energy. And finally, they adjust the dipole moment to match the linear absorption spectrum. And an important thing for me as an experimentalist is I've convinced them to only look at the linear absorption spectrum at this point. So they've nailed down all these parameters. You might ask why they need to adjust the dipole, and that's because it's a one-dimensional chain. It's not a full two-dimensional system. And it's one-dimensional just because of the computational overhead of doing these calculations. They can't do it for a very large 2D, two-dimensional system. So the only thing they're adjusting here to match the 2D spectrum is the dephasing rate, because you cannot get that from the linear absorption spectrum. So this will not give quantitative agreement, and particularly because it's a finite chain and it's a one-dimensional chain, but you'll see it gives very good qualitative agreement. So again, here is the experimental spectrum. So here is a theoretical spectrum at this sort of the simplest level. So the problem is that when they do this calculation, it's a many-body problem. And you inject an electron hole pair, it's going to interact with other electron hole pairs. And you have a hierarchy of interactions, and you need to decide how to truncate them. So in this case, they've decided to truncate them so that they form excitons, but that they ignore, so the electron hole pairs form, so that's the primary effect of the Coulomb interaction, but they ignore the interactions between the electrons, okay? So they call that a polyblocking, because the optical nonlinearity is due to the fact that once I put this electron hole pair in this particular excitonic state, I cannot put another one there. So it's basically the Pauli exclusion principle is what makes the system have a nonlinear response and give us our signal. They've calculated the absorption spectrum, so you see it looks pretty similar to this, not perfect. And again, this is their laser spectrum. And you can see that this is a really bad job. Okay, so first of all, the diagonal peaks do not have this dispersive line shape. There's really not much in the way of an off-diagonal peak, and you actually see this diagonal feature due to the continuum. So clearly, that's too simple an approximation. The next level is what they would call a Hartree-Fock, okay, or a random phase approximation. In this case, what they've done is they've truncated their hierarchy based on the order in the Coulomb interactions. And of course, this is a very, very common way to truncate this hierarchy in condensed matter. You can see it does a little bit better, so this line shape is starting to look a little bit more like this. You're seeing something here, but it's not the strongest peak, and the continuum has now separated itself into sort of a grid of peaks. The next approximation is what my theory colleagues call a full calculation. With all due respect for my theory colleagues, every calculation is an approximation. I call this condensed matter theorists learning how to do nonlinear optics. So what they've done is they've truncated their hierarchy of equations based on it being third order in the laser field. So they call this dynamics controlled truncation. And now you see very good agreement. Okay, you see that these lines look a lot more like. This is now the strongest peak, and you now see these vertical features here. So the message is that only the full theory reproduces the experiment. Now, with all due respect to my theory colleagues, they had been telling us this for probably 15 years before we did these measurements. They had said that. And the reason they said it was important was they could look at the strength of these terms. They could say, well, these correlation terms that they've included in this calculation or missing in this calculation are strong. Okay? And, of course, they can do that because in the computer they can set the parameter describing them to zero and turn them off. Well, I don't have a switch in my lab that says turn off correlation terms, so I can't do that equivalent check. Right? And of course, if I do the old one-dimensional experiments, I just get a decay curve, and they all look pretty much the same, independent of what level of theory I use. And so the important message to me is that these spectra are now so rich, there's so many features, that I think you can be fairly convinced that this guy matches this one even better, just on a qualitative way, okay? And there's no way, it turns out, you can adjust these guys to get a good match. So what's the message here? So the point is that semiconductors have a nonlinear optical response, and I want to claim that it's quite different than that in an atomic and molecular system. So in an atomic and molecular system, the dominant effect is the Pauli exclusion principle. The fact that if you put an electron in a state in an atom, you can't put another one there, and so that basically bleaches the absorption and you can't see more. In a semiconductor, it's mainly due to many-body effects. And I like this diagram. I don't know if you're familiar with this book by Matouk, where he does things like uses Feynman diagrams to analyze a drunk walking down the street or a pinball machine. But he has this to illustrate the idea of a quasi-particle. So he has a real horse and a quasi-horse with a cloud of dust. Okay, and so what I'm saying is that in a semiconductor, it's actually the cloud of dust that's more important than the horse itself. So if we think of the horses interacting, if all I thought about was the horses would interact because they didn't want to collide with each other. Or if they did collide, they'd fall over. But in a semiconductor, the dominant effect is probably the horse slows down when it goes in the cloud of dust of the other horse. And that's a much more important effect because the cloud of dust is much bigger than the horse itself. We can also do this two-quantum experiment in semiconductors. So now I sort of show you in an excitonic picture, ground state excitons and a bi-exciton. The idea is to generate a two-quantum coherence between the ground state and the bi-exciton. We can do this. We see a peak here. It turns out that we can then do it for, so this is actually the bi-excitonic peak, but we see this peak that's at the exciton energy. We really shouldn't see that. This is for cross-polarized pulses where we can actually create a real bound bi-exciton. So a bi-exciton is an excitonic molecule, a lot like H2. And we can switch the polarization where there's no state available here, but we still see a signal. So again, this is due to interactions. It's due to interactions that are similar to what I talked about in the atomic case. We also recruited theory help here. So this is the theory, and you can see quite good agreement. But what's interesting here is that this peak, which is due to interactions, actually shows up at the mean field level. So before I made a big deal that the mean field or the Hartree-Fock didn't do a good job, but now by comparing these, we actually have ways of sort of separating out the mean field and the correlation terms and comparing them. So here the correlation terms are what give rise to this bi-excitonic peak. So we've also done a pre-pulse experiment. I'm going to give you two examples of this. So one of these is in a quantum well, like I've been talking about. So we come in with this pre-pulse, it injects carriers, and then we do a 2D pulse. So if you've ever heard of a pump probe experiment, this is kind of a super pump probe experiment. This is the pump, and now the whole 2D experiment is the probe. So what's interesting is if we vary the intensity of this pre-pulse, so at low intensity, what we see is this peak here, okay, and there's a new peak as we increase it, which is due to the fact that we have bi-excitonic states. Now, what's curious is that if we look at a binding energy defined by the peak, the energy difference between these two peaks, is it actually grows as we increase the intensity of this prepulse. And that's completely opposite of what you expect for a bi-exciton. So what you expect is if you come under the prepulse and you inject carriers, these carriers are going to screen the Coulomb interaction, and that's going to weaken the binding energy. And so these two would tend to collapse back down. Now, there may be an overall shift because of other effects like band gap renormalization, but you would expect the bi-exciton and the exciton to actually come back together on top of each other, and that's not what we see. So what was going on here? Our theory colleagues in Germany proposed that what we were seeing is what they called a quantum droplets or a dropleton, which is this liquid-like state. Okay, so it actually has, for example, four electron hole pairs. They are not pairwise bound, but they're actually in like a droplet state. They can calculate the energies of these, and actually this overall energy trend matches very well with what we see. We did some other experiments that actually pull out this stepwise behavior. So the last thing I want to tell you about are quantum dots. Okay, so these are indium arsenide grown on gallium arsenide. So what happens is indium arsenide has a slightly smaller lattice constant. So when you grow it, it grows initially epitaxially. That means it grows in the same lattice structure as the substrate. But after a few monolayers, it realizes it has the wrong lattice structure, and it can reduce its energy by forming little droplets, and those little droplets are just the right size to give you quantum confinement of an electron hole pair. Okay? In this case, a detail for the experts, these are annealed to actually shift the ground state. This actually shows the luminescence spectrum. This is what we call the ground state exciton, and this is our excitation spectrum. So there's about 100 millielectron volts of confinement of these electron hole pairs. An important thing is that even though these samples are incredibly pure, there's still a little bit of background doping due to impurities. These generate some background carriers, and of course, where are the carriers going to go? They're going to go to the lowest energy state in the sample, which are these quantum dots. So about half these dots actually have a charge carrier in them, which we believe is actually a hole. They're slightly elongated, so this is actually an AFM picture showing them. This means we have an anisotropic potential, and now we actually have these linear polarization states as the sort of the fundamental eigenstates. This splitting is actually quite small, and this is a bi-exciton state. There's a pretty big bi-exciton binding energy. So let's look at a 2D spectrum. So now we see this very strong inhomogeneity. So it's elongated very strongly along the diagonal. We take a cross-diagonal slice. We get it fits beautifully to the square root of Lorentzian, which is what we expect. We can get a homogeneous line width. If we change the polarization, we now see new peaks. These are actually due to bi-excitons, and so this energy splitting from here to here is the bi-exciton binding energy. And I want to emphasize to you that if you think about this, if we just looked at the linear spectrum, there's no way you would see this peak here because a linear spectrum is basically a projection on one of these axes, and these are completely on top of each other. And so it's the fact that we have this diagonal correlation that allows us to pull out the fact that we have these bi-excitons. And that's basically the fact that the bi-exciton binding energy is much, much smaller than inhomogeneous width. A curious thing was this upper peak, which we were puzzled by for a while. There should be no upper peak in these samples. This could be an anti-bound bi-exciton. So what is that? Well, you know there's an anti-bound orbital for a hydrogen molecule, which normally falls apart. But remember, these guys are stuck in a quantum dot. So you can actually have a state where they have a repulsive interaction, which gives a blue shift, but they can't fall apart because they're in the dot. And people have seen this. But for these dots, we didn't expect that. So we did another experiment which revealed what was going on, okay, which is we looked at the intensity dependence, and it turns out this is actually a fifth-order peak, and so this is the intensity dependence of this, so it shows a slope 5. This is the intensity dependence of this guy, and so it shows a slope 3, which is what we expect, right? So we understand what's going on. Some of this has been seen before indirectly in Fourier mixing experiments. But now I want to remind you about something, which is Robbie flopping. So these dots are often described as artificial atoms because you can basically tailor their energy structure. And so they're very interesting for use in sort of quantum information where you could come in and do these kind of Robbie oscillations. And so a Robbie flop, for those who are not in AMO, all right, is if we illuminate a two-level system with a resonant electromagnetic field, there's this famous Robbie solution, which basically says the inversion. The inversion is the population of the excited state minus the population of the ground state. It basically oscillates, so this is a coherent effect. So if it was incoherent, it would just drive it to 50-50, but if it's coherent, you can put it all in the excited state, where this frequency is this so-called Robbie frequency, which is the dipole moment times the strength of the electric field. So this is basically an electric field we turn on at time zero, and then it's constant. Right? For off-resonant excitation, it's a little bit more complicated, but there's this so-called generalized Robbie frequency, which has the detuning in it. And so this plot shows you what happens. So this is on resonance, and as we increase the detuning, you see the amplitude of the oscillations get smaller and they get faster. So this is a strongly inhomogeneously broadened system, these quantum dots, and so if we summed up all of these, you could expect you might see this initial rise here. But by the time you got the intensity high enough, some of them would have come all the way back down, some in between. So if you average all this, you'll just never see this real flopping behavior. Okay? So people tried to see it in inhomogeneously broadened ensembles. It really didn't work. And so almost all the work in this field went to trying to the pain of looking at a single dot at one time and seeing them Robbie flop. Right? I will mention that dephasing causes these oscillations to damp out. So what we did, I just also want to say in points, so there's a so-called area theorem which says we don't need a square pulse, the actual shape doesn't matter, all that matters is this integral over the electric field. Okay. So we did an experiment where what we realized that this 2D spectrum is a size resolve measurement, right? And so we could overcome the inhomogeneity. So we again came in with a prepulse, it was going down the center of these pulses here, okay, so here's the prepulse, again this is like a pump pulse and this is now the probe. And so if we look at the 2D spectrum with zero prepulse, we see something that looks like before. Here's the diagonal peak, strongly inhomogeneously broadened. Here's this bi-exciton peak. We're going to call this the lower peak. And as we crank up that prepulse, okay, so we're actually going to, we're looking at these transitions here, and the prepulse is going to be on this guy over here. What we see is that this lower peak goes away, and we now get an upper peak. And so what's happening is, in this case here, this peak is due to basically driving this guy with the first pulse creating a population, and then the third pulse creates a coherence up here. This upper peak is because we now have a population in this state, so we can actually drive it up here, and then we actually see the depletion of this population. It's like the ground state depletion, and then we actually create a coherence down there. Okay? And so what we realize is that this lower peak is proportional to the population difference between this H and the ground, and this upper peak is the population difference between the B and the H. We drive it even harder, and we can actually see it coming back again here, okay? And we see this guy, and so you actually see some of these detuning effects here. If we now look at the data, this is the strength of that lower peak as a function of the pulse power, and again, since it's the electric field, I've taken the square root of the intensity, and this is the strength of that upper peak. And we looked at that, and we said, wow, this just doesn't work. This really sucks. I mean, that doesn't look like a Robbie flop. I mean, we're used to seeing these beautiful like this, and it comes back up. That's what we were looking for. So my postdoc Takeshi was quite dejected and went away, you know. I mean, he's, you know, upset that his experiment didn't work. And fortunately, he's smart, and he thought about it, and he realized, well, wait a minute. I'm not Robbie-flopping a two-level system. I'm Robbie-flopping that four-level system that has that bi-exciton state. these pulses are broadband, they cover all the transitions. I need to worry about not only Robbie flopping from the ground state to the exciton state, but actually simultaneously flopping the exciton to the biexciton. So he went away and he did the calculation, and lo and behold, it fits just beautifully. Okay, so this is the calculation of the four-level system. We can now assign a pulse area to these. It fits very nicely. These are actually the populations, so these are basically the difference in the populations. These are directly the populations, so we can see the ground state getting depleted. We see here the heavy hole going through a flop, and now this is the population getting driven in the biexciton. We can do it for different delays, so there's now sort of relaxation that comes in there. These are, again, the calculations that match very well. And then we can switch the polarization. So the important thing is we're driving the other state, so I think I put it here. So now we're driving over here, okay? And so when we probe this guy here, there's not a population in the state we're probing. So what we see is this guy just comes down, and then later this one comes up, because we actually need to create a population over here and then up into the biexciton before we start to see this upper peak. So it's kind of interesting. So this came out in PRL in September. It was an editor's suggestion, and it got written up in physics.aps.org. Unfortunately, you can see it was the same week as the Nobel Prize announcement, so I don't think anybody actually read it. They all looked at the Nobel Prize announcement. So we've done a lot more than this. This is just sort of a sampling. So we're looking at, so sorry, this is the quantum dot work. So we're looking at the detuning dependence. As I said, that was one of the features. It turns out that it's sensitive to what's called excitation-induced dephasing. We're also looking at the Robbie flopping of the trion. I didn't make a point, but the remaining diagonal peak is actually these trion states. It also shows pretty strong excitation-induced dephasing. This is the fact that the dephasing rate depends on how hard you excite it. And in general, there's a lot more. So we've looked at polarization dependence in quantum wells. We've looked at these Raman or zero quantum coherences. Looked at exciton-trion interactions in doped wells, double asymmetric quantum wells. This is kind of like an engineered dimer, so it's a lot more interesting than a molecular system because we can actually control it, and there's actually no effectively molecular vibration. We see some interesting effects. We wonder if this might have an impact on some of the controversy in chemistry about light harvesting and quantum effects. We're currently looking at colloidal quantum dots. And we actually have a new technique where we actually read out a photocurrent instead of an optical signal. So this has the advantage that actually that all the pulses are collinear. So we can focus down to very tight, look at a few nano objects, quantum dots. We've actually done work in looking at microcavity polaritons. And of course, this is part of a broader community. There's, you know, a lot of people working on this. This is Andrei Tokmakov's work. He was at MIT. He's now at Chicago looking at vibrational inharmonicity in molecules. Mike Fayer's group has actually used this to probe reaction dynamics. These cross peaks are showing that a reaction is happening. So Dwayne Miller's partly in a coherent superposition between Toronto and Germany has worked on looking at the dynamics of water, which are very interesting. And then there's this work on light harvesting centers from Fleming and Greg Scholes, also formerly of Toronto. So with that, I want to finish up. So I've shown you we've implemented this multidimensional Fourier transform or coherent spectroscopy in the optical regime. Our approach is these actively stabilized interferometers. I showed you the 2D spectrum of potassium vapor, showed good agreement for one quantum coherences, and these surprising two quantum coherences were due to interactions. This highlights how sensitive some of these techniques are to interactions. Looked at exciton resonances in semiconductors, showed you the dominance of the many-body effects and the importance of these higher-order correlation terms. Two quantum coherences actually reveal the mean field contributions, and finally, size resolve measurements on an ensemble and the fact that this allows us to do coherent control on an ensemble and still see the effects. These are all the folks in my group that have worked on it, and a lot of them are elsewhere now. These are some of the people that provided samples and theory, and so let me just finish with an advertisement. If you'd like to read more, Shal Mukamal and I wrote an article about 3 years ago in Physics Today that was a broad overview of this field. So with that, I thank you for your attention.